Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! It's a minute past the hour of this 20th day of February 2013. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com, available as a live stream at said URL under the button Listen Live, as well as on a wide variety of other internet-based platforms, not the least among them being TuneIn Radio, Stitcher Internet Radio, Dar.fm, Streama.com, Roku Devices, and many, many, many others. If you're listening by one of those others that wasn't mentioned, by all means, shoot me an email, bobkincaid@gmail.com, or better yet, shoot an email to me, throw mother from the train a kiss and all that, you know, throw me down the stairs my hat, and let me know how you do listen to The Horn, and we'll add that to the list. Podcasting address is, of course, at whiterosesociety.org under the subdomain for this program, Head On with Bob Kincaid. And you can always get the podcast at iTunes. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It is Wednesday, middle of the week, downhill to Friday, all of that. And there's just a ton of stuff out there for what would otherwise be a prayer meeting Wednesday. So much so that, well, goodness gracious, let's just review. Friends of Hamas. Oh, we got to do that one. We got that. But for pure for pure prayer meeting Wednesday fun, I kind of think we have to go. I think we have to go to L.A. And I know that may seem kind of strange. Usually for prayer meeting Wednesday, complete with a floor rolling, tongue speaking, strychnine swigging, serpent handling, we usually start out in a place like Alabama Stan or the Carolina Stands. But no, we're going to go to L.A. And I don't mean Lower Alabama. L.A. is, of course, the home of one Roger Mahoney. Now, we know that Roger Mahoney publicly embarrassed himself, or found himself publicly embarrassed, in the not-too-distant past by virtue of the fact that he pretty much got called out for having spent a great deal of his time as a cardinal, you know, covering up for kiddie rape, child sexual assault, child sexual abuse. And he has been excoriated here and in, well, a lot of other places for his role therein. But nothing really says religion industry like his response to being called out for his participation in something really, really nasty, to wit, the aforementioned child sexual assault cover-up. And thus, it is that how can I say this? I read this blog post and I shook my head and I wondered if I'd read it right, and I read it again. And, yeah, apparently so. So we'll just take this one straight, no chaser, and try to get through it. Everybody and their cousin but some of the stuff we have to say have to save for prayer meeting Wednesday. Now I'm looking at the America blog coverage. Which quotes a report from NBC. Retired Cardinal Roger Mahoney and other top Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Los Angeles officials maneuvered behind the scenes to shield molester priests, provide damage control for the church, and keep parishioners in the dark, according to church personnel files. The confidential records, filed in a lawsuit against the archdiocese, disclose how the church handled abuse allegations for decades, and also reveal dissent from a top Mahoney aide who criticized his superiors for covering up allegations of abuse rather than protecting children. At least there was one. Notes inked by Mahoney demonstrate he was disturbed about abuse and sent problem priests for treatment. But there also were lengthy delays or oversights in some cases. Nothing in there about indictments. So, Cardinal Mahoney, doing that deeply introspective stuff that one would perhaps expect of a priestly type. Well, he's got himself a blog. The blog is called Cardinal Roger Mahoney Blogs L.A. Personal Reflections and Experiences from the Archbishop Emeritus of Los Angeles. Here's the text. The blog post is titled Called to Humiliation. To be fair, this blog post landed on Valentine's Day, and we've not had a prayer meeting Wednesday since then. Called to Humiliation. From our earliest catechism days, we learn about the virtue of humility. We study it. We think about it. But we don't embrace it. Now remember, this is a guy who covered up for priests who, in sort of a serial fashion, had a thing for raping little boys. From our earliest catechism days, we learn about the virtue of humility. We study it, we think about it, but we don't embrace it. And why? Because humility is all about self-effacing, about seeing ourselves as far more diminished than we had hoped. As a result, few of us set out to embrace humility for Lent or as a pattern for our lives. I guess this is that season of the year when practitioners of certain sects spend a lot of time thinking about the stuff that accumulates in their belly buttons. That's why it's called Lent. Most of us accept a few affronts and neglects as humility and then move on. Yada, yada, yada. So, about four paragraphs on down the road, he writes, "Given all of the storms that have surrounded me in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles recently..." Really? Those were storms surrounding him in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles? Storms! Storms. Curious choice of analogy, metaphor. This would be metaphor. It's a storm when people get upset that the cardinal, who was supposed to be running their archdiocese, was spending as much or more time covering up for priests with a taste for little boy buttocks than he was in, you know, following the way of the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer who is an itinerant rabbi. That's a storm. "Given all the storms that have surrounded me in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles recently, God's grace finally helped me to understand I am not being called to serve Jesus in humility." Well, glad we've got that cleared up. Because I don't think it's serving Jesus in humility when you make it possible for priests to get away with buggery of little boys. When you not just cover it up, but in a way serve to facilitate it, become an enabler of it. He continues, Cardinal Mahoney does, "Rather, I am being called to something deeper." I wouldn't use that word, Cardinal. "To be humiliated, disgraced, and rebuffed by many." Count me in! At least he didn't cite the cast the first stone line from Mark. I don't think I could have taken that. I would have put a foot through the monitor. "I'm being called to something deeper. To be humiliated, disgraced, and rebuffed by many." You see what he did there? Jesus wanted him to cover up for priests raping little boys because it helped him be humiliated, disgraced, and rebuffed. Why, that's almost like being fed to the lions and becoming a Christian martyr now, isn't it? "I was not ready for this challenge. Ash Wednesday changed all of that, and I see Lent 2013 as a special time to reflect deeply upon this special call by Jesus." Really, Cardinal, I think I'd leave Jesus out of this. To be honest with you, and you know what? Anytime you see or hear someone say that, doesn't it mean that you can look at all the words that went before it and say, well, oh, so he wasn't... Okay, got it. To be honest with you, I have not reached the point where I can actually pray for more humiliation. Notice how nobody said he should. I'm only at the stage of asking for the grace to endure the level of humiliation at the moment. Now, I'm no cardinal. Shucks, I can't even turn a magic cracker into Jesus meat. But I might suggest that if you really want to put together a serious list, you might ought to get busy praying for the ability to be humiliated for the rest of your life. But it's not really humiliation that you're needing, Cardinal. You're needing shunned. You're needing driven from polite society. Go borrow Yocasta's brooch and do the Oedipus thing and wander hated in the wilderness for the rest of your natural-born days for what you did to make it possible for your subordinate priests to put their sex organs in little boys. He In the past several days, I've experienced... Oh, we haven't gotten there yet. Oh, no, we haven't. By the time we're done, you're going to realize that Cardinal Mahoney, well, he needs to come on down that blood-red aisle and fall on his knees in front of the... and put his hands on the subwoofer. Because he ain't getting the message. In the past several days, I've experienced many examples of being humiliated. And we're not counting the rent boy that he paid to pee on him or anything. Wait, what? No! In the past several days, I've experienced many examples of being humiliated. In recent days, I've been confronted in various places by very unhappy people. I could understand the depth of their anger and outrage at me, at the church, at about injustices that swirl around us. Now, see, Cardinal, they're not swirling, buddy. You helped create the injustices. You don't get to get all Geraldine and holler, "The devil made me do it," over this one, okay? But here it is. Oh, here it is, the money shot from Cardinal Mahoney. Thanks to God's special grace, I simply stood there asking God to bless and forgive them. Really? Forgive. See, that's where you haven't got the whole walk of faith thing down just yet, Cardinal, because you don't ask God to forgive people who are in no need of forgiving. Because they weren't doing you any wrong, Cardinal. Raj. That was the voice of God you were hearing. Spoken through his people. Assuming, of course, there is one that does that kind of thing. You know, big juvenile bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky. The people who criticized him in the church, well, he forgave them. And then he says, strangely, the more I allow all of this to unfold without protest and objection, the greater the inner peace I feel. Can you imagine that? People standing up for little raped children are in need of the Cardinal's forgiveness. New Pope, old Pope, meet the new Pope, same as the old Pope. As long as Cardinal Roger Mahoney's out there thinking he has something to forgive, no, that's a different Mahoney, Marty. That's Sean, he's in Boston. But as long as old Raj is out there trying to convince people that the ones needing forgiving are the ones who are criticizing the church for having created a culture of rape, as opposed to the people who were doing the raping, whose rapes were covered up, whose raping was covered up, and who were protected against the forces of the system of justice that would otherwise have taken down anybody else who had done such a thing and put them in prison nearly for freaking ever. Well, I think we can safely say that old Mama Church is pretty much dead and done for. Isn't it? that forgiven thing. He needs to be doing some more work on it. Because he doesn't quite have it down yet. Ick. Just ick. Oh, by the way, Michael sending along a little note via Facebook. He says, I gave up fabric softener for Lent. He'll be here all night. Try the veal. Don't forget to tap your waiter. Tip your waiter. Ba-dum. Little note in from Jim. You might recall that our Tuesday broadcasts are now named Titanic Tuesday for the Titanic right-wing wit who does or attempts to do. I have a great deal of respect for him. It takes a lot to get in here every day with no talent whatsoever and do a couple of hours of radio. It takes courage. It takes guts. And that guy does it. But apparently, the sequester that Jim and I talked about ever so briefly last night, in right-wing world, over on in the 962nd tier of right-wing broadcasting, has become... You might want to sit down and strap in for this. You know, get the tennis ball and the duct tape out. A little, yeah. It's a sea quake. No, really. It's a sea quake. He supports the sea quake, saying the effects of it will be minimal. I got that way too early in the afternoon to start drinking. By the way, our buddy Sergi has gone into competition with Michael. He says, I got Michael beat. I gave up my dryer for Lent because the fire department warned me all that buildup could cause a fire. Oh, you're a funny bunch, you are. Jim noting that sea quakes could be caused by buggery. One never knows. So, that's a starting place at the very least. But having mentioned the sequester last night and Jim asking, well, what will it affect? Almost as if on cue, we get a sort of generalized answer from the folks over at Think Progress. Here's their laundry list of what you can expect out of the sequester. And it's rather an expansive list if you get right down to it. Inside the sequester, you'll find a loss of things like, oh goodness, they write, jobless workers will lose access to unemployment benefits, while safety net programs for women and children and early childhood education programs will face deep cuts. Well, so far there's a lot to love there for the right wing. The sequester will cut funding for, and here's the laundry list, law enforcement and border security, food safety, because what's a little E. coli among friends, airline travel security, more on that in a minute, Head Start, disaster relief, and health research. Defense programs, the article claims, will also see reductions. As Jim said last night, and as I tend to agree today and last night, those will be accomplished through blue smoke and mirrors, and nobody's going to be pressing their little noses up against the frozen window panes from the Pentagon. More, please. It'll cost about, the sequestration will cost about 700,000 jobs. So there's your answer. But in there, airline safety. Airline travel security. Right? Doesn't mean you're going to stop having to take your shoes off. It just means there will be less people to get it right. I've done a lot of, you know, or not a lot. It's not like I'm a member of some frequent flyer club with a, you know, with those George Clooney up in the air miles. No. But I've gotten kind of used to it. It's inconvenient, but not overly so. I have been patted down. Just about every time, as a matter of fact, because, and I'm not trying to go into too great a level of detail, but I've taken to liking wearing suspenders. I like to wear suspenders to keep my pants up because it's less constrictive than a belt. And because removing the belt from my pants, because of the way my body is built, can often result in what I call a level one pants down emergency at TSA screening. Nobody likes those. So when I come through the little machine, I have to stand there while the TSA official checks out my suspenders. It turns out the artificial intelligence has not seen enough people in suspenders to be able to, you know, recognize sweat-conditioned geezer. I've always liked suspenders. Braces, for those of you who are far more civilized than I. These are the little clip-on affairs. You're going to have to find another pair of suspenders because on the way back from my recent journey to Wisconsin, I went through security, as I always do, and the little brass tabs on the suspenders, of course, lit up, as does, for some reason, the little middle panel in the back, which is okay. I explained to him that that's what always happens, and they're quite genial about it, except for this time, and it wasn't like I guess they wear out, or maybe they were made in China. Probably, and just of inferior materials. But this time, when he put a finger in to just run fingers down behind the suspenders, the little leather piece that hooked the suspender to the clasp, well, it gave out. And it came up and whipped me right in the eye. Show me. Proved I wasn't a terrorist because, well, I kind of went, ouch, whereas terrorists are much more tough and would just, you know, they'd just take it as part of the job. Found one pair of suspenders now, but it wasn't gross and it wasn't offensive. Frankly, far more offensive are the sizes of the seats inside the aircraft. There's no getting comfortable, especially when you start bouncing around the sky like, you know, well, like a roller coaster on acid. That tends to happen on the little regional jets that run from Charleston to Atlanta and back. But anyway, airline security and safety. Yeah, things like air traffic controllers for the FAA. Or maybe this. I found the story, the story kind of jumped out and grabbed me when Agnes shared it with me because it was a story of something that happened on one of nearly the very same flights I was on, Minneapolis to Atlanta. A mother and her child, you know, with infants, you can, a parent can travel with an infant sitting on their lap and not be into it for a, you know, for a whole nother ticket. Jessica Bennett is 33 years old. She lives in Minnesota and she has a 19-month-old son. They were seated in row 28, seat B, on Delta Flight 721 from Minneapolis to the ATL. Her son well, you know, when you begin the descent, the pressure changes again, and it can affect babies and adults alike. And the little baby didn't like it. The little 19-month-old little boy started crying. Well, it turns out that she had been seated next to a guy who Jessica Bennett said she had spent most of the flight standing in the rear of the plane just to get away from this guy because he smelled like booze and he was slurring his speech. But, of course, when you begin the descent, you have to get in your seat and you have to put your seatbelt on. There's no way around it. And that she did. And when the pressure change affected the little baby's ears, the little baby did what almost every baby does on an airplane, began to cry. It's not pleasant. We forget as adults that the things that make babies cry are things that would make an adult cry were it not for the fact that we are already accustomed to them. The shock to the system. And so when the little baby began to cry, Mr. Joe Ricky Hundley, tip-off, of Hayden, Idaho, second time around, looked at Jessica Bennett, age 33, of Minnesota, and said, shut that N-word baby, and he didn't say N-word, up. Shut that baby up. And slapped the baby. Yeah, really. Slapped the baby. The child, of course, screamed even louder after it had been slapped. He has since been charged with assaulting a minor by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Atlanta. He has been released on bail. And his lawyer is doing her dead-level best to try to stem some of the negative PR coming out of this.
This has escalated into a racist issue, and I want to be clear, he is not a racist. Even if he did use that word, it doesn't make him a racist.
At which point in time we can ask, well, what does? Because shut that N-word baby up is a pretty racist statement. Or perhaps the for-profit media would say, racially tinged. Other passengers helped Ms. Bennett. They also heard the slur. They saw him slap the baby. And What happens when the sequestration takes place? Where was the air marshal? Oh, dear God, I missed that part. Jeremy, just writing in from Vermont, mentioned that the man you're speaking of is also a teacher out there in Idaho Stan. Marty pointing out, perhaps we should nominate the plane's captain for allowing the drunk passenger on his or her plane. The captain can throw drunks off at his discretion. Probably wasn't doing anything until, right. I don't think he got, it doesn't sound like he got loaded on the plane, because Miss Bennett was up and walking away with the baby. Once the plane reached cruising altitude, that only takes a few minutes. Yeah, see, this is what happens when you try to apply rational thought to an irrational situation. Texas Betsy asking, what did he think that slapping the baby would accomplish? What do any baby abusers ever hope to accomplish? It is merely an expression of moron fury. Jim noting, been there, have spent many a flight in the WC, even during the landing procedure. There are two places where you do not show your ass, an airplane and a shrink's office. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I try to be a genial, friendly passenger. I get on that plane, I got a smile for everybody. And sometimes you have great conversations. But I can also note that I also make it a point never to drink on an airplane, or before one, and usually not after one, because that means there's going to be some driving involved. Figure. I remember flying to Paris last spring. And it's like the road company of Blazing Saddles was back in the economy cabin with us. Cowboy boots, hat, the works. It was an Air France airliner. And I can't tell you, honey, bring me another bottle of that wine. And then this from Dr. John. Fair to ask, would he have slapped a white baby? And come on, Idaho? No offense, I know there are good folks there, but isn't it basically ground zero for white Christian identity militia types? Why, yes, Dr. John, yes, as a matter of fact, it is. Idaho, working every day to make Alabama look good. Jack in Shreveport asking, I missed part of what you said, but the slapper guy was some rich CEO type. Rich folks get away with a lot. I don't know if he was. Jeremy in Vermont has informed us that he was a teacher. Pale, pasty face, doughy, white hair. Jesus Christ. No, it's not. It's not me. Joe Ricky Hundley. Not Joseph Richard Hundley. Joe Ricky. I'm thinking he emigrated to Idaho. That sounds real Texas Stan. Sorry, Betsy. Just is. Joe Ricky. What do you do?
Marty pointing out, I'll drink on or before a flight, never both. As you well know, Bob, alcohol in the airport and on the airplane is not cheap. Well, and there's the economic explanation. Oh, okay, okay. Betsy's struggling. Sounds Oklahoma to me, she says. Joe, now I'll get a note after the podcast runs. I'll get a note from Horst. I'll be damned if that's Oklahoma. No, knowing Horst, he'll say, yeah, it could be. Joe Rickey could also be out, but to be fair, Louisiana, Arkansas, Alabama, Tennessee, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Kentucky, not so much West Virginia. It's not really, that's your deep, yeah. All right, all kinds of stuff out there. Clayton, the militant sociologist, pointing out, heard he was an exec of the airline, now fired. This guy must be, this guy's like St. Paul. He's all things to all people. Okay, Jack's on the hunt. He's going to try to find a referencer and try to sort this out for us. But anyway you slice it, I think going back to Dr. John's question, would he have slapped a white baby? Would Joe Rickey have slapped a white baby? Okay, this kind of, see, I love it when we work together like this. Marty saying he is not a teacher. He's some kind of aerospace industry company exec. Now he's unemployed. Business executive who slapped toddler on plane. Fired from job. It's a double bonus. Has been fired from his high-profile job in the defense sector. AGC Aerospace and Defense said in a statement, reports of the recent behavior of one of our business unit executives while on personal travel are offensive and disturbing. We have taken this matter very seriously and worked diligently to examine it since learning of the matter Friday afternoon. As of Sunday, the executive is no longer employed with the company. Ms. Bennett, the mother, said, I could not believe he would say something like that into a baby or about a baby, and then to hit him was just, I felt like I was in another world. I was shaking. Now, here's an aerospace industry exec who also has a past assault conviction from 2007. Is this the time that might it be appropriate at this point to recall the study that says that corporate executives tend to display many of the same traits as your common garden variety psychopath or sociopath? Right. Ron and Raleigh noting, haven't we all at one time or another booked a flight on screaming baby airlines? The combination of being crammed into a cattle car with wings with folks that believe common courtesy is a horse in the third race at Pimlico, you have to find your quiet place and deal with all the vagaries of air travel. By God, that's literature. With folks that believe common courtesy is a horse in the third race at Pimlico. Yeah, I go on with a smile. I sit down and try to unfold my knees and get them. I found a new trick. They will go ahead and check your carry-on bag all the way through to your ultimate destination at the gate, if you so desire. And I do so desire. And so I walk on the plane with absolutely nothing, so that means I can at least extend my leg fully. Or almost fully. And yeah, get in my happy place. Sure, I've been on planes with screaming babies. And as a parent, I like to think I've got a little bit of sympathy. Dr. John pointing out, this is interesting. The parents are white. Their adopted child is of color. Now work that into the equation. Little post-racial blues going on there. Because it was just the mama and the baby, not the mama, the daddy and the baby. So Joe Rickey done made him some assumptions about what mama done did. Got it? And yes, Joe Rickeys do that. Dr. John noticed the on personal travel line from the story Jack sent along. Yeah, the company wanted to make sure that everybody understood he was not flying out for the big contract meeting with Amalgamated Widget. Dr. John asking, what? Personal travel? What? Was he going to visit the Tomb of the Unknown Cracker? There you go. Now, if we had time to just stop the show, we could do a little research and find out about that there company. What was the name of it again? He's an aerospace exec. He's out of Idaho. They are a contractor with the government. AGC Aerospace and Defense. Anybody want to find out what they do? Wouldn't it be funny if they were a drone company? Maybe we could make certain arguments about how being associated with that dirty business will tell on you after a while. AGC, Aerospace and Defense. All right, we've got two votes. One from Clayton, one from Jim. Clayton noting, I want to use this time to renew my membership in the Mile High Club. Oh, no. Could it be? Jenny got busy. Did some quick digging. AGC Integrated Defense Group, AGC Aerospace. son of a gun, there's a picture of a drone on their website. AGC Integrated Defense Air Technology is committed to serving our commercial, government, and international customers with high-quality, state-of-the-art products and services that enhance the capability and performance of their aircraft. That is our mission and our passion. Well, you know, when we're not slapping babies around, or when our executives aren't. Our company has the experience and the motivation to provide prompt one-on-one service and to deliver only the best equipment, technologies, and personnel to fit each customer's specialized need. One of them is located in Oklahoma City. Jeebus. So, well, who knows? AGC might be taking a little bit of a hit with the sequester, too. Not something you want to fool around with. Merciful saints. So I don't know where it goes, but we have apparently reached the end of at least the first hour's filibuster. And a reminder, we are, as of this moment, $135 away from finishing up Donald's challenge from last week. We are about $800 away from finishing up February. And so, with that in mind, our buddy Robert in Australia has written in. He said, 20th of the month down under, $100 challenge. Robert is also known as Phase 5 in the chat room. And there it stands. So, if we all get together and we meet Robert's $100 challenge this evening, we will have then, in turn, matched Donald's kind contribution from last week and be on track to finish February okay, which means, hopefully, that we won't have any of the weirdness that we had last week. At least that's the plan. PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. And remember, to meet Robert's challenge, we're only talking about 10 folks at 10 bucks a piece. 5 at 20. Yeah, you know how it works. Thank you to everybody who's stepped up so boldly in this unpleasant and otherwise weird month. It's on the table. PayPal button, headonradionetwork.com. So too is the snail mail address, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. And remember, please don't make checks or money orders payable to Bob Kincaid. Make them to the Horn, Head On Communications, Head On Radio Network. Like that. Yeah, I see the research continues. AGC is the parent company. Thank you, Marty. AGC is the parent company of the one that Mr. Hundley was president of, Unitech Composites and Structures. Bad day out at AGC. Ron has kindly provided the evening's bumper going into the top of the second hour. And like I said, one of the ongoing ambitions, and I hope I can pull it off, is to get the 800 number out of Hawk, or actually out of its hostage situation. Yeah, you're right, Betsy. Oh, now, that's a weird one. The clock on the production computer is 4 minutes fast, 5 minutes fast this time. Usually it runs 3 minutes slow. Yeah, I need a couple of days to mess with that. Well, Ron, I was going to go with your bumper. But the browser's not cooperating. So we'll have to find something else. You really had it. Oh, there it is. Okay, hold on. It's cooperating now. Radio on the fly here at the Horn. So we will. We'll take a little break. Come back with your emails, your calls. You know the number, 304-658-3333. And via Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. They're both up and running and waiting for you. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. Me, I'm Bob Kincaid.
Janis Joplin! Cry, baby, cry, baby, cry, baby. Welcome back home. You know she tired. She told her that she loved you much, much more than I did. But I know she left you, and you swear that you just don't know why. But honey, you know that I'll always be right. If you ever want me, come on and cry. Ain't nobody ever gonna love you the way I tried to do. To take your pain and all your heartaches. And honey, you know that I'll always, always be right. If you ever want me, come on and cry. True, darling, that the grass always looks greener when you're looking in somebody else's eye. But honey, enough the real thing, we're waiting for you at home. I saw you did. I had a man. He said, honey, honey, You know that I love you. See, but I gotta go find myself, you know. I gotta go find my life. I gotta go find myself over in Africa. Or over in New York City. Or over in Olima. Someplace those cats are always wandered off to. I never figured exactly where it was. I was going somewhere, man. And I said, baby, don't you realize? You're looking for your life over there, honey. You know where your life is? Your life's waiting like a goddamn fool right here. For you, man. And one morning you're going to wake up in Casablanca. One of those fancy places, honey. You're going to be freezing to death, man. You're going to wake up and you say, good, good, Lord. Good, 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 Lord. I just went off and left that woman in that great big huge double bed with a great big fur rug on top of it. No satin sheets, man. What am I doing in Casablanca, man? I mean, really, man. One of these days that cat's going to wake up and say that to himself. And when he comes back home, there, just like a Capricorn that I am, I'll be standing there waiting. Said, baby, I knew one day, and I knew one day, but you finally come on home to me, honey. When you walk through my front door, I'm gonna be able to tell by the look in your eyes. I'll say, good God, that man finally done got it. Lord, that man finally done realized. So you can put your head on my shoulder, baby. Cause I know you got some more tears to shed, dear. So come on, come on, come on.
Your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Four past the hour, this really is hour number two of this Wednesday, the 20th of February, 2013 edition of The Horn. And a special thanks going out. Betsy and Jack have taken care of the first $60 of Robert's Down Under Challenge for this February. Thank you to both of you. Only 40 more to go. And that will also finish out meeting Donald's challenge as well, which is awfully cool. Nothing like a little Janis Joplin. That was Ron's call. Email immediately came in from Dr. John. Subject line, excellent song choice. There's a quote attributed to Janis. I've never looked to see if it's real or not. It references my hometown. The gist of it is, quote,
There's a town in southeast Texas called Beaumont, and it's the asshole of the world. I'm from Port Arthur, Texas, which is 18 miles up the asshole. And then this from Michael, and it's going to require an answer back from Ron. Michael writes and says, I knew one day I'd hear some Janis and not know what recording it's on. Lordy, where is this? Yours, from Nero Lima. Michael. We'll work on it. We used to say in the electric journalism business, we're efforting a response on that, Michael. Which is not nearly as much fun as... Okay, so I referenced it at the beginning of the program. This is like something from How Not to Do Journalism 101. Naturally, it's a Breitbart story. You know, of course, about all the kerfuffle, and I'm still awfully fond of that word, all the kerfuffle surrounding Chuck Hagel's nomination to be the Secretary of Defense. And you know, a lot of it has to do with whether or not he has bowed and scraped enough to Bibi Netanyahu. Or whether once upon a time he said something that was not absolutely condemnatory of all Arabs and Muslims everywhere, that didn't sit well, again, you know, with Bibi Netanyahu and all the congressmen he owns. Well, part of that, at least in the universe of the confirmation hearing process, which bomber John McCain personally squirreled, had to do with a question put out by some Republican about whether or not Chuck Hagel had dealings with friends of Hamas. Now, you, me, we're not professional journalists, but we hear the very words friends of Hamas, and we kind of chuckle because you just kind of know that no such organization exists, don't you? Friends of Hamas. It would be like, oh, I don't know, the Anti-Hitler Defamation League. It's so ridiculous that nobody in their right mind would take it seriously. Well, that's what happened. It turns out that a writer for the New York Daily News, his name is Friedman, but he's not that Friedman, made a call, and he wrote about it in the paper. He made a call in an attempt to find out, you know, sort of behaving like the kind of a journalist, to find out what it was that these senators were, who it was that these senators were concerned that Chuck Hagel had taken money from. Dan Friedman is the writer. And he says, on February 6th, I called a Republican aide on Capitol Hill with a question. Did Hagel's Senate critics know of controversial groups that he had addressed? Hagel was in hot water for alleged hostility to Israel. So I asked my source, had Hagel given a speech to, say, the Junior League of Hezbollah in France? Or what about Friends of Hamas? Dan Friedman writes, the names were so over the top, so linked to terrorism in the Middle East, that it was clear I was talking hypothetically and hyperbolically. No one could take seriously the idea that organizations with those names existed, let alone that a former senator would speak to them. Or so I thought, he writes. The aide promised to get back to me. I followed up with an email as a reminder. Did he get $25,000 speaking fee from Friends of Hamas? I asked. The source never responded, and I moved on. Enter Ben Shapiro, long referred to as the Virgin Ben. Because, lo and behold, February 7th, the goobers over at Breitbart.com put up a headline that read, Secret Hagel Donor? White House spokes ducks questions on Friends of Hamas. Now, you see how this worked? The reporter, using language that he assumed would be understood to be at least somewhat sarcastic, asked a Republican Senate staffer what this means. Yeah, this he took money from people allegation, vague and baseless. And somebody got on the blower right away to the boys over and girls over at Breitbart.com. Still named for the really, really creepy guy who, I don't know, methed out early? Ben Shapiro wrote in the story that a White House spokesman hung up on him when he called for comment. He used that to make it appear that the White House had not denied the Friends of Hamas claim. He then tweeted the story out to 40,000 Twitter followers. Red State grabbed it and ran with it. The National Review linked to it. And then, while in Israel, Mike Huckabee said, rumors of Chuck Hagel's having received funds from Friends of Hamas would, if true, disqualify him. So our intrepid reporter called back the source that he'd made the original statement to, and the source said, I didn't share it with Breitbart, but then mentioned that, well, maybe I mentioned it to other people, and they mentioned it to Breitbart. And this is how they handled it over at Breitbart once they got dinged on it. Ben Shapiro said, the story as reported is correct. Whether the information I was given by the source is correct, I am not sure. You got that? Anybody who's ever been through a ninth grade journalism class is having a fit right about now. The story as reported is correct. Whether the information I was given by the source is correct, I am not sure. Now, I don't want to get all technical about this, but if the information in the story is not correct, then doesn't it follow that the story isn't correct, too? But this is from Breitbart. Being factually accurate is not exactly something that they care much about. But I wandered into this little story by mentioning that we were efforting a response. And that's a delightful little improper verbization of it. Right. There's no such thing as efforting. And I mentioned efforting and leaped into this story because of another thing that darling right-wing Ben Shapiro said. You know how the line about journalism it might correct or maybe, yeah. You know how that kind of made you a little crazy? Well, this may send you screaming out into the yard. The other response, from Ben Shapiro was as follows. The story Breitbart News ran originally was accurate and clearly caveated. Caveated. I caveat, you caveat, he, she, it caveats, we caveat. Oh dear, amo, amas, amat, caveatimus. Caveated.
The hell does that mean? I mean, we all know it comes from the it's a Latin word.
Caveat emptor, meaning buyer beware. It means beware. So, the story was bewared. Doesn't make any more sense that way, neither. God. Oh, by the way, going back, just so you can know, Unitech Composites, which is where Joe Ricky Hundley was previously an executive who was on personal travel, they do metal-to-metal bonding, metal-to-composite bonding, squirtum, S-Q-R-T-M, same qualified resin transfer molding, squirtum, filament winding, precision laser placement of composite layers, composite-to-composite bonding, EMI shielding, sandwich panel construction. I always wondered where those little boxes came from. Did you get it? Never. Hot melt salt. It doesn't sound so tasty. I wouldn't put my hot melt salt in my paneled sandwich box. Vacuum bagging. You don't have to have one of those with a vacuum cleaner that picks up bowling balls, do you? Room temperature curing. Oven curing, autoclave processing, environmental auto control systems ducts, yeah, you want to bet there's any of those in a drone? I bet you need some hot sandwich box construction if you're going to build yourself a good drone. Caveated, yeah, we got Jack on the floor in Shreveport. I got a big laugh out of that one, says Jack. Randy with a fair question. How come I keep getting Breitbart and O'Keefe mixed up, other than the fact that one is dead and the other not? Well, eventually you won't get those two confused because they will have equal status. Watch this space. O'Keefe, of course, was Breitbart's little protege until he wasn't. And we have an answer to Michael's question. Ron says, I love Janice too. That version of Crybaby is on the Festival Express DVD from 2004. Festival Express DVD, 2004. Okie doke. 19 past the hour. Lines open if you want to jump in. 304-658-3333. Bob Kincaid Horn on Skype. From Marty. Visions of Cleavon Little from Blazing Saddles. Oh, baby, you are so talented. And they are so dumb. Are we awake? And the rest of that, and the rest that goes with that. By the way, I didn't get to this one last night, but it really needs to get out there for your consideration. I need to tweet a photo around if I haven't already. Ferg and I were in the store the other night, and he said, "You got to see this, Dad." and he picked up a box and held it, and I took a photograph of him holding it. When you want to get your 6-year-old into shooting culture, you want them to have something that you want them to have something that'll really inspire them to stick with it. And while they do still manufacture the Red Ryder, the Daisy Red Ryder lever action BB gun with a compass in the stock, in 2013, that just isn't meeting the needs of a lot of your 8-year-old future awful gun owners. Nope. Not at all. So imagine my shock, my horror, neither of the above. Just another daggum day, really, when you get right down to it. When Ferg held a box up for me of a BB gun, Black Ops Tactical M1 Viper Assault Rifle BB gun, complete with banana clip, complete with a battery operated thing so that when you fire, when little 8-year-old Adam Lanza to be fires his BB, his M1 Viper assault BB gun, the BB gun will actually kick him in the shoulder just like a real one would if he was mowing down a room full of toddlers. And it's not like we saw that before Newtown. It's on the shelf all over the country right now. Which takes us to Missouri. And a little something that went down on the 18th of February there in what we used to call Jefferson City, there on the banks of the Missouri River. It is the Missouri River that Jefferson City's on the banks of, isn't it? I think so. It's the state capital of Missouri, where Representative Mike Lira, a Republican, introduced legislation that reads as follows. Quote, "Any member of the General Assembly who proposes a piece of legislation that further restricts the right of an individual to bear arms as set forth under the Second Amendment of the Constitution of the United States, shall be guilty of a Class D felony." I don't know that much about representing Mike Lira. Oh, the Missouri House of Representing. But I'm guessing he's not sharp enough to have come up with that on his own. In the wake of Newtown, looky, what the NRA is working on now. Their position is so weak, their argument so pathetic. Their leader, Wayne LaPierre, so utterly psychotic, that now they cannot even brook discussion of the issue. Any member of the General Assembly who proposes a piece of legislation that further restricts the right of an individual to bear arms shall be guilty of a Class D felony. The fans of constitutional law in the audience will say, "Hey, but Bob, what about the speech and debate clause? What about it? Constitutions? We don't need a stinking constitutions. All we need is the Second Amendment, and that'll provide all the freedom we need." But there's at least a soupçon of irony involved with this.
That Second Amendment, that's what preserves and protects our freedoms. Unless we're going to talk about guns, in which case you ain't got no freedom to talk about no guns.
If nothing else, take comfort in the fact that in some alternate universe, we really are reaching for the stars by now. Probably got an outpost on Mars. Cured cancer. But that's probably the same universe where we dealt with the secessionists the way they needed to be dealt with early on. Instead of mollycoddling them for the next 150 years. So that they could rise up once again and try to destroy what they couldn't destroy the first time. Our buddy the Angry Indian was right on point. He said, why are we not calling these people neo-Confederates? That's what they are. Right you are. Right you are. Oh, by the way, we got a dispatch in from Cassie, who is doing what we want Cassie to do, plugging away. She says, "Can't you just get a new 800 number?" And wasn't it 866? No, it was 877. And you can't exactly just get a new one because it's all tied up with the other phone lines. And yeah, they get you over a barrel. And Cassie notes also, people shouldn't hit babies or call them N-words. But you knew that, right? Indeed, we did. I'm proud that you do too, Cassie. So, jump in on the phone lines. This is Conversation Radio, after all. It's not Filibobster Radio. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, you're at it again.
Ah, there I go again.
There you go. I think that gentleman who committed that faux pas, for lack of a better term, I think basically his company deals with like skins of airplanes that will deflect radar and things of that nature.
Right.
I think that's their basic contribution is DOD contractors. I do believe that's what he does, or has a lot to do with what he does.
Or, well, we might have a different verb tense in play now, did.
Well, who knows? I'm sure there's somebody going to employ him very quickly, very soon, and all this will pass right over, you know.
He does have a date with the federal court in Atlanta, so.
Oh, that can be a bit of a sticky wicket.
Joe Rickey, you slapped who and said what, sir?
Well, you know, if you're a defense contractor like that, you're bound by under certain rules, and I can guarantee you one thing. I'm sure when the contracting officer representative for that company got a hold of this, they had to respond with extreme alacrity.
Yeah, the sirens went off.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, airplanes, like I say, are very strange places. And I was just watching, crawling across the Internet, something about if you put your seat back, that's not good because the person at the very end will be deprived of 1 cubic feet of space at the end of the airplane if you try to recline your seat. And I thought, well, that's pretty interesting.
Well, the very last row of, at least on the 737 I was on to and from San Francisco, that 73, the last row of seats were hard up against the wall, well, against the bulkhead, so you couldn't recline that seat at all.
That's what they're saying, basically, that these passengers who are against the bulkhead are deprived of at least 1 cubic feet.
Well, that ride was like a hockey match, Jim. I mean, I got hip checked about every 15 seconds for 5 hours.
That's fun. I've been there, done that. My response to the whole thing was to spend as much time in the bathroom as I possibly could, because at least you had a good wide seat.
Yeah. It didn't recline either, but.
No, but at least you have something to grab hold to, and you could just tell the stewardess, look, I have some enchiladas, and they're not agreeing with me. It always worked for me. And, of course, there were more than, you know, that was the only restroom. And I'm going to tell you, I've been through some pretty wild rides while sitting on the front of this stage, and that's for sure.
Oh, I have no doubt.
Well, you know, at least you don't have to suffer from claustrophobia in there because it's a little bit wider. But nonetheless, so much for airplane travel. Like I say, I've spent many, many, many thousands of miles in the air, and I can certainly sympathize with the way things are. And they're not going to get a hell of a lot better, that's for sure.
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't enjoy getting loaded on the plane. And it's let's understand something here. That flight from Minneapolis to Atlanta is just a 2.5 hour. You know, it's not some 6 hour cross country affair.
Oh, I've been on that flight. I know exactly. You know, having to go to Department of Education meetings in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and I had been on that flight. Sure have out of O'Hare. And so, no, it's not a long flight, but it seems a hell of a lot longer. And I can remember when airplane travel used to be a lot more civilized than it is now.
Oh, yes, indeed.
And it certainly changed a great deal, you know. You used to be able to...
Well, I've had emails from members of the Horn family around the world saying, Bob, someday I hope you get to fly, for instance, an Asian airline where they treat you like a human being.
Oh, yeah. Japan Airlines.
JAL, KAL, Singapore.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because you know what? It would be kind of fun. A first class ride, say, from L.A. to Singapore or, you know, L.A. to Sydney, something like that. That'd almost feel kind of comfortable, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah, it would. As a matter of fact, I had a couple times when I was on commercial flights and because of seating problems and this, that, and the other. And, of course, I was always flying on the government ticket, you know. And there were a couple times when they would give me a first-class seat. And, Lord, the difference between that and coach or business is just, well... I don't mean to be vulgar. It's the difference between chicken stuff and chicken salad.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been there, done that. Oh, by the way, your bumper music. I loved it. But, I love Janis Joplin. I thought she was wonderful. If you have a chance to play any more of her, I wish you could look up Move Over.
Okay.
I was thinking about you on the plane.
That's a good call, too.
Yeah, Move Over. That's a good song. I can remember seeing her on Dick Cavett and... all those squirrel tails in her hair, and she was just incredible. Just an incredible performer, and it's so.
And she left for as short a time as she was performing, she left a heck of a legacy in terms of the amount of performance stuff out there. Like Ron said, this was from a DVD that was released in 2004.
You know, I still have a vinyl of her. I think it's called Move Over. I'm not sure, but it's a picture of Janis reclining on some type of multicolored sofa, like some type of Victorian sofa or something like that. It's been a long time since I pulled it out of the sleeve and stuff like that. But she was just incredible. She had a lot of good things to say, and it's a pity that her life ended so quickly. But we lost a lot of people in those days, that's for sure.
Yeah, and now it looks like Dr. Drew has bumped off his fifth one. You're familiar with, what is it, Celebrity Rehab?
Please enthrall me with your acumen on that, if you would, sir.
No, the Celebrity Rehab is one of these icky reality shows.
Oh, dear.
And Dr. Drew gets involved with their lives and helps to try to make them better.
Mm-hmm.
And the latest one is Mindy McCready. you know, singer.
Yeah, she did herself in.
Yeah, after a, right. But that's five now that have shuffled off this mortal coil, having been on celebrity rehab.
Hmm.
Now, you take the rigors of a reality TV show, and I imagine they are significant. It can't be fun having somebody walking around you with a camera 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And you take someone who is, since they're on celebrity rehab, probably in an already fragile state.
Well, I would think that having that type of circumstance in your life would tend to exacerbate the situation and not ameliorate. You know, these people are going to show the very worst they possibly can because they're told to by these people who are making these films or documentaries.
And yeah, so you've got to be outrageous. You've got to be over the top.
Yeah. I mean, thanks to Sandra, I finally got to watch Honey Boo Boo.
Oh, no. No, as Sandra would say, oh, no.
Oh, no. I can't believe that this is on the air and these people are actually having contact.
Wasn't there somebody... You know, if you're tempted to do something like that again, Jim, drop an email. No, Jim, no, don't, no, not that channel.
Well, you know, it was like looking at a train wreck or a car wreck or something like that. I was fixing to switch it off, but then it became so outrageous. I mean, these people are, you know, basically they're farting in public and seeing who can cut the loudest fart and this, that, and the other. And I said, what are you doing watching this? Good Lord in heaven.
Oh, my God. You were talking to your... How long before you started talking to yourself, Jim?
5 minutes. Minus 4 minutes, 30 seconds. And I thought to myself, my God in heaven, what in the world has this come to now? And between that and Buck Wild and some of the other stuff, and, you know, there's...
Well, one of the Buck Wild kids got taken down for smack.
I wonder why. Yeah, it's just incredible. You know, going back to this business with Chuck Hagel, just exactly what are these people trying to do? I mean, were they talking about Hamas being an organization? Or some type of Arabic dish.
Oh, the hummus joke. No, the for some reason, and you remember Chuck Hagel was a former Republican. It's not like he's some fire breathing liberal FDR Democrat.
Well, that's one of the reasons, because these people feel as though he's betrayed them, and he is, you know, playing the part of some type of Judas.
Well, yeah, let's take that a step further, Jim, and understand that if by some operation of his dark, demonic Kenyan Muslim socialist powers, Barack Obama was able to reanimate the dead flesh of Ronald Reagan and nominate him to be the Secretary of Health and Human Resources, where Ronald Reagan would then have a free hand to cut people off of iron lungs like he did in life. The Republicans in the Senate would try to throttle that nomination as well. And this is not necessarily some sort of full-throated defense of Barack Obama, but at this point in time, the Republican Party is engaged in a chorus of whatever you're for, I'm against it, you know, from Groucho Marx.
Well, speaking of that, what about the... Clavering they're going to have next month in D.C. with the CPAC.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, did you see who the headliner is?
Please, you tell them I can't.
Caribou Barbie. Mussolini.
And not only that, but the guy who is Monsieur LaPierre.
Oh, yeah. I forgot Crazy Wayne was going to be there.
He's going to be there.
Is he gonna bring his shooting gun and hold it over his head like Chuck Heston did and say, "You can have my guns when you pry it from my cold dead fingers"?
Maybe he will. maybe he'll really show what it's all about and open fire on them. I don't know. I mean, it's just so, it reveals to me these people have not changed one bit, and they're not going to give in one millimeter. I mean, Boehner has already said, well, I got my 98%, and that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
And Mark tells me that Alan West will be there. Goodness gracious, it's a Rhodes Gallery.
Yeah, I mean, the best Rhodes Gallery I've seen like that were old films of the people who were sitting in the docket at Nuremberg.
There you go.
I'll tell you, it's just incredible the kind of madness that has overtaken our government and its ineffectiveness because of the Republicans for recalcitrance. You know, they are so angry they lost the election that they're going to use any means possible to destroy any efforts that could be attributed to the current administration.
Well, look at the efforts that are going. They're going to damn well see this sequestration happen.
Oh, absolutely.
Understanding. I don't get real broke up about the notion of the Pentagon's budget should probably be cut by something like 25%, 30%, 40% if I had my way.
And now the latest on that is they're going to have to work one day for free. Some 23,000 some odd DOD employees. But, that's what they're saying is, this conference.
Yeah, that's the impact on the Pentagon.
Right.
What's the impact on somebody who just doesn't get their unemployment anymore?
Well, basically,
are we gonna say the same thing to the FAA that the air traffic controllers are just gonna have to work for free?
I would hope not. It would appear to me as what's fair for the goose is fair for the gander. But, I mean, this whole thing is so enveloped, and like I said last night, in smoke and mirrors. I mean, I dare say that most of those employees will lose one centime, not one two, not one dime. You know, that's just...
But on the other hand, the real human being, well, I mean, the real people who depend on things like that, it's not quite the same story, is it?
No, Bob, I guess it's just another result of a sea quake.
Jesus, I saw that. You sent me your... What?
No, you should have heard one of the replies now. Here's the latest that's going around through there if you want to hear it.
All right.
If you got your Imatrol near. The federal government, quoting them, not me, please, don't attribute this to me, please. I've made enough enemies on this program, but nonetheless, they're saying that the federal government is going around buying up all the ammunition so that people can't buy any more.
Because they're going to get our guns. And is that when we can expect to see our dear friend over there marched off to the FEMA re-education camp?
I guess so. I think he should have been marched over there a long, long time ago. I just can't understand.
Well, I don't think a re-education camp would work with him because that presumes there was some education on the front end.
Yeah, you made a very good point there. But it's just incredible to hear how some of these people are of such disposition to get on the air and say this kind of stuff. Now, what's this business about them attacking even Rush Limbaugh? I hear he's on their S list, too.
Who's?
These right-wing crazy people that, you know, apparently Rush is not being supportive or something like that. I just caught the end of it. I thought maybe you'd seen it.
Oh, dear God. Oh. But now that you've mentioned it, somebody will follow up and we'll get to the bottom of it. I'm guessing it probably has something to do with, you know that there's an internecine squabble going on right now relating to the fact that Karl Rove has said that he, by God, will now vet all potential GOP candidates for national office and make sure that no more Todd Akins get run.
Karl Rove.
Mm-hmm. And so the teabaggers are all mad at Karl Rove.
I just wonder how long before this whole thing just falls in on itself.
It couldn't happen soon enough to suit me.
Nor I either. But, I mean, it's just incredible to hear what I'm hearing over the news and seeing the things that I see. And, Lord have mercy, it's just like some type of white trash.
Yeah, it's a reality. The Republican Party, the teabaggers, it's all a Republican Party the reality show. It's Republic Boo Boo. Here comes Republic Boo Boo.
And they really believe this stuff.
Here comes Honey Boner Child.
Very well spoken. Very well spoken, exactly. And like I say, if you see so much viewing time of your television schedule occupied by stuff like this, you know, I can see why. The dumbing down of America. You know, we were talking, I think you were talking last night about social studies from one of your teachers in Texas.
Yeah, Texas Betsy.
And, you know, they want to completely, if they can possibly do it, eliminate any type of social studies that will at least give kids a grounding of some type in true history. And they want to do this their own way, so they'll have a generation of functional idiots as far as the history of their country is concerned.
Right, because then they can just invent it on the fly. And they can say things like, what's his name? David Barton, that dear bosom buddy of the Beckerhead, who says that, for instance, Abraham Lincoln was an evangelical Christian with a close personal relationship with Jesus Christ. When Abraham Lincoln freely admitted that he confessed no creed and did not expect an afterlife. I mean, these aren't speculative things. These are things that are documented.
I understand.
You know, Thomas Jefferson did it. He didn't rewrite it. He edited. Thomas Jefferson edited the New Testament.
Well, I mean, since when has education become hagiography?
But that's what they want it to be. Remember back before he exited stage hell and went down to turn on a spit for all eternity. Jerry Falwell said that we need to get the government out of education and get it back in the hands of the church where it belongs. Because then you can make sure that children aren't taught things like devil evolution and demonic biology.
But you know, Bob, you can go back into history in the 30s. This is exactly what they were doing in Germany in the 30s and how they were educating their children.
Well, anytime you have the rise of autocracy, the first thing you have to get your hands on, Jim, is your history. The Germans did it, but so too did the ancient people of the Valley of Mexico before the Spaniards arrived. The so-called Triple Alliance that held sway there had only been in power for a couple of hundred years, and the people who were at the head of that confederation, the Mexica people, we call them Aztecs.
Right.
They were Johnny Come Latelys. They'd only been there for 200-300 years and rose to preeminence, and the first thing they did when they established their power was to completely rewrite their own history. It happens.
Oh, yeah.
And it happens whenever you have governments arising that want to control not only the way people think about their present, but the way they think about their past, if they think at all. Because if they are thinking the party line, then it makes it that much easier to control how they respond to the present.
Well, exactly.
I mean, America is a very different place if you've got everybody convinced that Thomas Jefferson, for instance, was an evangelical Christian, and he wasn't a Christian at all. You know that. I know that.
Right.
But there are people in Southern Baptist churches and Methodists and whatever all over the countryside that have been convinced by this David Barton character that he did everything but speak in tongues.
I know.
And from that you get to make the entirely spurious claim that this government was founded on Christian principles, which anybody who's ever run across the Treaty of Tripoli knows there's a statement in the Treaty of Tripoli that closed up the whole Barbary Pirates mess that says that the United, and I think this is pretty nearly a quote, the United States is in no wise founded or based upon the Christian religion. And that's only because it's true. You know, these people want to think that there was, you know, the word God does not even exist in the Constitution. And the only reference to it inside the Declaration of Independence is to God and nature's God. Which is certainly open to interpretation.
Well, it certainly is. I mean, you know, Benjamin Franklin was a deist, and Jefferson did not have the ties to the church that they claimed he had.
Adams was a Unitarian, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah, I know. And there were a lot of these people were known as free thinkers. And, of course, there are a lot of people who don't want you to know that, and hence, you know, there's just been an attack upon social studies, and, of course, kids aren't really getting an education right now, and I think it was referenced last night on this program, the only education they get is they are taught to answer the questions to a test.
Right.
Hence, you know, no child left behind.
Right. I mean, there was some of that annual testing was going on before that, but no child left behind, or as I call it, no child behind left, raised that up to a level of critical mass whereby test performance would determine whether or not a school stayed open.
Of course, absolutely, absolutely. And here we have, you know, good old W sitting in his bathtub. Well, I think that was one of his big deals, wasn't it?
Yeah. I forget who wrote that into me. Maybe it was Michael, who said that it doesn't take a lot of analysis to realize that anybody who's obsessed with painting pictures of himself bathing has a conscience that wants a redo.
Like I said last night, it's a pity that, you know, Charlotte Corday isn't there with a knife. As, you know, David painted Marat. You know,
right?
And that during the period of the French Revolution, or I was just thinking, is George spending so much time under the waters to try to cleanse himself of his many, many errors and deliberate mistakes?
Out, damned spot comes to mind, doesn't it?
Well, it does, but not all the perfumes of Arabia was going to cleanse that one little hand.
Nope.
Much less all the water he can sit in, whether it's from the tap or whether it's from some type of deer park or whatever. But, I mean, when you sent me those photographs last night, I thought, oh, my Lord. I just wondered where in the Bush Presidential Library they're going to hang those things.
Oh, dear God, I didn't even think about that.
Well, it was kind of like some of the Hitler art exhibitions he used to hold in Munich, in which, you know, he would have all these Nazi-inspired painters who painted according to the party line. You know, they're the ones who were exhibited. And even some of the Italian visitors to those exhibitions in Munich, I think it was in 1937, Hitler had a big Festival of German Culture or something like that. And you can look at the films of them, and they're just standing there with their mouths open. They can't believe what they're seeing. I mean, you know, good Lord in heaven. I mean, you've got this big picture of Hitler with a...
And the most you can say is, I can honestly say I've never seen anything like it.
Well, that's all you could say, or else you'd find yourself... on your way to
on the night train out of Munich.
You well, Sachsenhausen or whatever. But, I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, that this fool would actually do paintings like this. And, you know, I was just thinking about this, and I'm not trying to drag the conversation out. But, I mean, what type of mind is going to produce things of this nature? Of himself in a bathtub or standing in the shower.
Well, I'm sure if we were to hand this over to a competent psychologist, then there would be something to be said for the fact that the only way he pictures his face is in reflection and the other photo doesn't contain his face at all.
I guess you're right, Bob.
Because, for instance, you know, in dealing with children who've been abused, there's a very famous little test out there. You don't tell the children it's a test or anything, but it's called the house tree person test.
Mm-hmm.
You ask a child to draw a house and a tree and a person.
Mm-hmm.
And you can pretty much get a handle on where that child is in terms of feeling safe. Feeling good about his or her surroundings, family structure, by what you see in that house tree in person.
Oh, absolutely.
And I thought of that when I first saw the Bush paintings. He's only got a reflected face.
Maybe that's because he can't look into a mirror or look in himself as he really is. I don't know. I don't even know if that man has any type of conscience or not. I don't know. I think his conscience is dead. And basically, this is a manifestation of that. But I don't have any more to add to that other than my disdain for what's going on. And
well, just for the love of God, stay away from Honey Boo Boo, will you, Jim?
Oh, but Bob, it's just, I mean, it's like I say, it's almost addictive. Because, basically, I've had to tie a kerchief around my neck to keep my mouth from just, to keep flies from
See, you just gave, yeah, you bring such erudition, Jim, that you've just created a mental image in the minds of the entire Horn family of you sitting there in front of your TV set, just slack-jawed with your mouth hanging open, catching flies. Oh!
Well, you know, it's kind of like that. Jacob Marley, when he came back to visit Scrooge, remember he had the kerchief tied around his mouth to keep it closed?
Right.
I mean, when I saw this, I just sat there and I said, my God.
Haven't got around to Buck Wild yet, have you?
No, I can't handle that anymore. I mean, these people are so stupidly woodenly stupid. I mean, you know, it's just.
Too much.
It's too much. So, look, on that note, you've got people who probably want to talk to you, but I've just said what I had to say, and I thought I would just bring that business up about.
Well, I appreciate it, and, you know, I'd make sure that I watertight sealed all the doors, because you never know when one of those sea quakes is going to send a tsunami right down Harper Road.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm worried about those sea quakes. As a matter of fact, I had to call the person about my flood insurance. I mean, you know, what can I say? Who are, you know... Where I live is going to be turned into the Nautilus, except I won't be able to get away like Captain Nemo did. So you have a good one.
You take care, Jim.
Good night.
Bye now. Sea quakes. Good God. I think Sandra's with us. Hey, Sandra.
Hey, Bob. Can you hear me?
I got you.
Listen, I can't even believe that guy who slapped that baby. I don't know what. How even to approach that? I mean, he was drunk. Is that the excuse?
Apparently so. Well, I mean, the mother says that she spent most of the time on the flight carrying the baby back at the back of the airplane so as to stay away from him because he smelled like booze when they got on the plane.
Yeah, well, no, but I mean, to me, you know, it's just, it really is. It's just horrific. I don't understand what is going on in somebody's head. I mean, yeah. So he just slapped a 2-year-old.
Yeah, and scratched and left a scratch.
Right. No, I heard that it was the poor deer was at a small... Oh, anyway. So is he trying to say he's not racist? Is that what I heard you say?
That is the direct quote from... Even if he used that word, it doesn't mean he's racist. That's what his lawyer said.
So we got another one of those water isn't wet type situation, huh?
That's exactly what it is.
Wow. I mean, oh, my God. It's... I just hope that he gets prosecuted, and I hope the people already got lawyers. They should sue. I would sue because you shouldn't have to go on a plane short of it crashing. You should be able to feel secure enough to have your kid with you to get from point A to B without being...
Well, absolutely, but you understand that that's why that one adjective was right there in the middle of the press release from the company that canned him. We are distressed by the way this man, by the way he behaved while he was on personal travel. That's basically telegraphing the fact that now listen here, lawyers, we don't want you filing any respondeat superior claims against this here company.
Somebody's gonna get sued though. I mean, there's no way either they can sue that man that slapped the plane, the airline, somebody, because that's just an outrage. You should expect a level of safety when personal safety when you board a plane. I don't know what the justification is going to be from what airline is it?
Delta.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. You know, I think there is a level of responsibility, with that airline. What? Or is it that if you pay, it's just you're on your own? Is that the logic?
I don't think so, especially in light of at least the way the fact pattern looks to me, Sandra. It looks that she says that she got up with the baby and walked to the back of the plane. And, you know, anybody who's ever flown knows that you get up to cruising altitude, the seatbelt light goes off, and people start using the bathroom.
Yeah.
So you can get up and move around once the thing's leveled off at 30, 35,000, 40,000 feet or whatever. And on a 2.5-hour flight, and I know this to be a fact because it's the ride that I was just on, it is 2.5 hours from Minneapolis to Atlanta. If you're spending an hour or more standing back of the plane, there is no way that the flight attendant is not going to look at you and say, "Why are you back here?" At which point you say, "Well, you know, the guy there in my row next to me is drunk and hateful."
Okay, so is it a hate crime? Has he been charged with a hate crime too?
No, he was just charged with assault of a child.
Okay, but it's in the air, it's federal, so they should pile on some of those charges too, right?
One would hope. I mean, you would think that the use of the word would justify it.
Well, I just, you know, I mean, I'm just looking at, I mean, you know, we live in a punitive nation, so it should be like a long line of charges here, right?
You would hope so, all the way down to stream littering. But on the one hand, flying is not pleasant, but it does not have to be outright nasty. And frankly, if you're an airline, if you're an aerospace defense contractor executive, one would think that you travel enough fairly routinely. If you see the photos,
yeah.
he's, I don't know, I'd guess he's in his mid-50s to 60s. Probably, well, I think there's four or five of those flights out of Minneapolis to Atlanta every day. And because I don't know this, I don't have the details to know this. Maybe somebody will do the homework. What time was this flight? Because I'm sorry, if you're on your fifth gin and tonic and you're getting on, you know, my flight out was at 10 o'clock on Monday morning.
Yeah, but they already reported that he's been done for a DUI, so there's a history of alcohol abuse. You see what I mean? So
yeah.
I mean, I don't want to say that anytime someone gets done for a DUI, they're an alkie. But most times when someone gets done for DUI, they're an alkie.
There's a problem.
Well, because you know, people have driven you know a little tipsy, but you got to. You know, you'd be driving around a lot for the odds. your ass to get. So I assume that once you get after so how many times and drunk, I mean.
And so it was 10 o'clock, and he's sitting there stacking up little mini bottles of Bombay Sapphire. There's something on. Because, you know, they, bless their hearts, it doesn't matter what time of day it is. You can always get a drink at the airport.
Yeah, well, I just think that there's some, you know, there's some funny liability. I mean, I'm sure those people haven't talked to an attorney. That's all. I, that's
oh, no, they're already lawyered up.
Oh, right. And I don't blame them. That's
no.
The thing that, that, you know, it's outrageous.
But the undercurrent that, that Dr. John pointed out, Sandra, the fact that she was, and the husband wasn't there, she was a white woman with a baby of color on her lap. And he is, and he is what, Joe Rickey from Idaho? I mean, can we just fill in some fairly small, obvious blank spaces in that and figure out how you wind up with a slap baby?
Yeah, and I can also add, well, maybe that poor baby was crying when you got a gander at that face. That dude, you saw him, right?
Yeah.
Shit, that baby probably was scared as hell. I know I was when I looked at that face.
Yeah, and stinking of liquor? Sure.
Yeah, and, but you know, stressful with kids on plane. And then it was funny because the article I read right below had, and some airline, some Asian airline, introduces child-free flying. I don't know if that was some sort of, you know, Google ad or what the hell it was, but it was so insensitive. It was like, hello? So this.
Yeah, they haven't quite got the algorithms all worked out yet,
yeah.
Have they?
Well, no, it could have been. I don't know what it was, but it was just like, hello? So it was like the first, you know, 14 aisles, no kids, and it was just peaceful flying. I'm like, well, this is real appropriate. But anyway.
No, see, I was thinking back. We never did. And at one point in time, we had three babies in strollers and one walking. And we never did take them on an airplane.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you can avoid it, I mean, it's not nice, man. It's hideous.
But also largely because, you know, Agnes ran this family with an iron fist. Granted, in a velvet glove, but, I mean, for instance, if we were sitting in a restaurant somewhere and one or two of the babies started hollering, I'd get the look. We'll be in the van, she would say. Have ours boxed to go. Because she would not let our babies disturb other paying customers' dinner hour.
Yeah.
And so, I get it. There was actually, the one time she's flown was the trip out to Vegas and back. And on one of those flights, it was zany. She was seated near a crying baby and was all solicitous toward the mama, and it's okay, and don't you worry, and Agnes is wonderful that way. And Ferg, meanwhile, who was on the second flight of his entire life, is sitting next to some nun who looks at him and says, "Son, would you like to pray with me that we don't go down in a ball of flames?"
Oh, no. What?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, sitting there working them rosary beads. Keeping the plane in the air. Oh, God. He still tells the story.
Projecting her neurosis on a poor child? That's
yes.
Charming.
Yeah, oh, it was. It was just delightful.
Well, I mean, I always just totally feel for the kids because the ascent and descending is horrific on your ears. So the little ones are probably, in you know, very uncomfortable. So,
oh, it is. It's unpleasant and... And then
right.
Add into it to what I had going from here to Atlanta just last week. Those little commuter jets are just nightmares.
Yeah, you know, so, I mean, it's not pleasant, the whole experience. You put young kids in the mix. The last thing you need is some impatient, crazy, drunk racist coming at you. I mean, I heard her husband say, you don't know what kind of restraint. I mean, I know that's no restraint. That fool should have got knocked the hell out on the plane. Sorry.
Yeah, and you just kind of wonder what was going on because there was something about the man was restrained. So you don't know if the air marshal or what. And by the way, Marty has done the research work. Air Asia X.
Oh.
Is the one with the child-free flights. Rows 7 through 14 are off-limits
right.
For passengers younger than 12.
Right. No, I was like, damn, okay, thanks for that when I was reading the information, just in case. So, anyway, I just just was, you know, sort of flabbergasted as you are with that whole story. But what I wanted to talk about was, let me just a general question. It's about the Keystone, but it's just issues in general. Why is it that on the Republican side, we know across the board, Keystone, if Romney was president, day one, it would be a done deal?
Absolutely.
Right? Okay, but on our side, we can't have such unity over an issue like this. No. We got to have people trying to say, oh, no, we'd rather get oil from Canada than Venezuela. I don't understand what that means because oil is fungible. And so what the hell are they talking about? Socialist oil versus capitalist oil or what the hell?
Well, if they could build a pipeline from Venezuela, they'd want that, too. But no,
yeah.
That's...
But no, what I mean, though, is that's sort of one argument.
No,
that's coming out, and it's just ridiculous because can we make it clear for these writers and even Obama who said, oh, well, Canada is going to get the... They're going to do what they're going to do no matter what we do, and it's not true.
That is wholesale not true.
And Ed Schultz was saying the same thing today. I'm like... Good night.
No, wait, stop. Ed, really?
Yeah, he was trying to say, oh, I can see both sides to it. And he was talking about in terms of, oh, Canada's going to get it out no matter what. And it's like, can we at least get the facts straight? They need pipe capacity. This is a huge part of this issue. Whether or not you believe in climate change or not, let's not be disingenuous because... If they could get the oil to the west coast of Canada, don't you think they fucking would? Don't give me that. That's just complete.
Well, right, and that's the whole thing. Apparently, the Canadians have said, "Oh hell no," and
that's
really
what I'm saying.
Have dug their hill. That ain't going. That pipeline ain't going to Vancouver.
Right, and the indigenous people have more say. And so they're using the power to say no to that route. For the landlocked resource of tar sands. So I'm listening to, Ed Schultz, and I'm like, OMG, you are not, you know, so he's trying to say, well, Obama may go ahead and do it, but he's going to lose a lot of supporters, you know, and not giving all the facts and, you know, arguing.
Yeah, but can we just kind of run down that rabbit hole real quick and understand why Ed would say that? Because...
I seriously think he don't have all the facts. But what are you saying it is?
The only reason Ed Schultz even exists on a national basis is because of the way that he was able to leverage a lot of labor money. Okay, I don't think the Sierra Club or NRDC or any of the big greens have ever given him so much as one thin dime. But he has gotten a lot of labor money, and organizations like the Teamsters are out there baying at the moon for the Keystone because we want the jobs.
No, but they don't have, they didn't put up 30, 40, 50,000 people the other day either. I mean, that's the thing that I'm sure is making those on our side a little bit nervous. They're like, damn it, can you just go away? That's the impression I'm getting. You know, that kind of stuff, you know, where, there can't be any unity on any issue on our side. And
well,
to
no,
me,
look at the dumbass rape comment from the guy in Colorado. You know, allegedly a Democrat.
No, I didn't hear that.
Oh,
what
yeah.
He was trying to
make a larger point. It was in a discussion of whether or not to have concealed carry on university campuses in Colorado. But he wound up really shooting himself in the foot by basically making the allegation that women are too hysterical to be trusted to shoot the right rapist.
Huh?
Yeah.
What does that even mean?
Well, that they might, you know, if somebody, that they can't be, is it a rapist or is it not a rapist? And, you know, shoot first and ask questions later. And he was making the larger point that gunning up is not a good idea, especially on a college campus.
Right.
And talking about the things that they, you know, they've got safe spaces, they've got call boxes, you know, with the blue lights, they got whistles, they got, but he just did a real bonehead thing. And that, again, is an
is a reflection of the same thing I think that you're raising here, Sandra, is that we cannot have unity on an issue because we're afraid of what the other side will do.
Well, I mean, it's just, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm not, you know, I understand the side that wants to increase, bring the pipe, because it's obvious. It's a landlocked area with a potential of huge amounts of oil resources, and they want to get it out of there. That's not difficult to understand. But the fact that we got to hear, you know, so-called liberals and progressives justifying this madness without explaining, the oil infrastructure. They don't talk about it. They just talk about it as if there's jobs that will be lost, and they're going to get the oil somewhere, so they might as well bring it here. Why must it go here? Because it's going on a global market. What difference does it make if it's Venezuela, Canadian oil, or anything at this point? Our gas prices are still near $4. So
right, and they're not, they're not going to go south anytime soon.
Well, I don't know. I just am kind of, you know, it's just a bit, you know, kind of distressing because, you know, they can't get past the hippie kicking, and they're still giving out fake information. They don't even acknowledge that most of the jobs will be Canadian, not U.S., the few that are going to be. I mean, there's so many issues with this. It's completely outrageous, and I don't know. I just...
But you've got a significant proportion of this country, Sandra, that thinks that they're going to be buying $2 a gallon gas if we can just bring the tar sands to Houston.
Well, yeah. I mean, I saw a picture of the route, and, you know, I didn't realize the amount of water that's at risk.
Yes.
Holy Christ.
The Ogallala Aquifer affects the entire western United States.
Anyway, so it just seems to be ridiculous that this is even a possibility. Just on the strength of that, why in the world would anyone, why is anyone willing to risk that water source, full stop?
Well, A, and B, what information does there need to be now what information is there that would make this a palatable choice? It goes back to your original question. That thing would have been approved on day one with Willard Romney. Why was this thing not just put in the garbage can on day one with President Obama?
Exactly. And this is the thing. I mean, and that's it. True. That's truly the right question to ask. Also, the idea that a foreign multinational is taking people's family farms down in Texas right now, that shit is off the chain, too.
Yeah. It's the larger picture of what happens if you're running a hydrocarbon-based industry. That report that Brad and Desi referenced in last night's Green News report, that the Canadian government has been hiding the fact that people are getting poisoned and dying around the tar sands extraction sites. You know, it's the same thing as what goes on here in Appalachia. It's the same thing that goes on in southern Illinois. It's the same thing that goes, you know, same.
No, but
people are property rights, all that sacred stuff that the teabaggers and the libertarians lose their minds over. It all goes out the door.
It all goes out the window, and it's sort of this may be neither here nor there, but the company you keep, and who was that fool golfing with, Bob?
Yeah, oil executive.
I mean, you know, I'm sorry, I'm not gonna sit here and think, oh, okay. You know, to me, it's just a slap in the face. It's like, I'm going to go down here and play golf on some nasty-ass golf course and with some oil people while you...
And Tiger Woods.
While you little people march around up there. You know, I mean,
I'm not going to run out there and get on the same side of an argument with the creepies at Drudge and Breitbart and stuff, but it's kind of hard not to on this one. President Obama went down to play golf with some oil executives and Tiger Woods, and forbade photography in it. Well, if I was doing that, I would too, because I would not want the people who just voted for my ass to see me out there hobnobbing, rubbing elbows with an oil executive.
Yeah, no.
And of course, you know, the people at 350 have gotten wind of it, and they're blowing it up. I saw a big blast email from Jamie Henn out there at 350 talking about the very thing right before showtime.
Well, they need to be blasting out. I don't know. Maybe they must have. They need to be coming up with what strategies they're going to try for if the thing is approved. I hope there's a plan B, C, D on this.
Well, I'm sure there is, but...
Well, I don't, you know, because once again, I keep going back to Ed's shows because I'm like, no, most people don't understand the linear integration of the fossil fuel system that needs to be kind of explained. So people can be more informed. They need to understand, A, oil is a commodity that's now sold on the open market globally. If they don't have the capacity, the tar sands will pretty much die out because the investment is too high. You see what I mean? None of these things are being explained. We're just being told that jobs and the horrible environmentalists, that these are the two options we have.
Right, because, yeah, and it's, well.
And we don't even, and when I say the horrible environmentalists, I mean that we, you know, on our side, there's no unity behind them. They're just another interest group that needs to be managed.
Right.
Whereas on the Republican side, the oil is not that is part of their whole scene. You see what I mean?
Yes. Absolutely.
There's nothing to be managed for the Republicans.
And I dare say that because you know that this climate rally was a joint venture between 350 and the Sierra Club, okay? I dare say the Sierra Club blew its bank account out funding this thing. It was kind of a historic moment because Michael Brune, who came to the Sierra Club from Rainforest Action Network, is a big believer in civil disobedience. And this was the first time ever that the Sierra Club had signed off on acts of civil disobedience.
Right.
But they spent a fortune bringing buses into Washington, D.C. For a rally was impressive. 35,000 to 50,000 people on the Mall in D.C. is not small potatoes. And I have a tremendous degree of respect for the effort. But you've got to be able to bring those people out time and time and time again. And frankly,
not only that, but some of the tone was, I mean, it was some good things going on, but there also was this level of, oh, we got your back type of hell type of attitude too. And I'm sort of like, you know, all that kind of gives me the heebie-jeebies because, our side is so schizophrenic when it comes to the first black president, you know?
Yeah, well, absolutely, because and that tone was struck. You know, you're exactly right. You know, we've got to have this man's back because there's a recognition in that, Sandra, that he's afraid. This is a no-brainer.
Golfing with oil people. Where's the fear, Bob?
Because he's afraid of the tar and feathering he's going to take from the right wing media, which means the vast majority of media in the United States.
And you don't need to be afraid. He down there with a fucking sex maniac. He don't have to be reelected, so he can go play golf with that fool. So I think the fear is gone. He don't got to be reelected, so I'm not too sure about that one.
Well, maybe you're right, and maybe that's why that modern pipelines line was in the State of the Union speech.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I just am sort of, you know, and of course, I'm not coming at it from some kind of balanced approach. I'm straight up like, you know, you need to know who you're dealing with on some levels. And to me, you know, you're golfing with all that was just like, I don't know, you know. Who knows? Like I said, if I'm proven wrong and he says no, it's a great day, you know, for my nieces, right?
Exactly.
So I look at it like that, but I can't help but think he ain't never, you know, come out with a strong decision about shit unless it's what brown person he gonna take out. Sorry.
Well, and Andy just wrote in, and he says, where was Mr. Obama on Sunday? Andy says, I was demonstrating against the XL pipeline down on First and Market in San Francisco. Mr. Obama was doing what the top 1% do. He was golfing. And with whom? Golf partners. Tiger Woods, Milton Carroll of Houston, the chairman of CenterPoint Energy and another Obama donor, and James R. Crane, a contributor and the owner of the freight company EGL, the Houston Astros baseball team, were all running a good walk. The guy, Mr. Obama, is just not with the people. He's not with the planet. He's not with the future. He's with the top 1% and the plutocrats. He sacrifices nothing for the President Bill Clinton good life he's looking forward to when his term is completed. And I think you have to take that into consideration. And it's kind of sad. It's really sad. Because, yeah, you're right. If this thing does get turned down, Sandra, it's a great day for your nieces, it's a great day for my grandkids, and it's a great day for the year 2100.
Well, and because, you know, the argument that, oh, well, it doesn't really contribute a huge amount in itself to the gases is neither here nor there. We need to stop these big projects, and this is a start.
Yeah, but somebody's right and somebody's wrong on this, Sandra. McKibben said this is the fuse to the biggest carbon bomb that the planet faces. And I tend to believe the man. He's deeply sincere, and he's earnest in a way that I haven't seen many other people be earnest.
Well, no, what I mean is that, yeah, if they don't have pipe capacity, then it can't be released.
Right.
And if they get this first pipe, then all sorts of other pipes will come online. This is what am I not understanding this?
No, you're right on top of it.
Okay.
You know, that's why, going back to the State of the Union, the phrase he used was modern pipelines. Not modern pipeline, modern pipelines. And there's all, you know, there's all kinds of ramifications about around this. For instance, you know, I've mentioned a couple of times the dismay I felt when I read that story about, I think it was the Crow people in Montana selling out their lands to be strip mined for coal. Well, the only reason you do that is if you anticipate that Union Pacific is going to get what they want, to wit, that massive rail line that they want to see built between the Powder River Basin of Wyoming up through Montana across, you know, and winding up basically at Bellingham, Washington, where they want to build 3 or 4 coal terminals to send all that shit to China. And that's that encompasses more carbon. It reduces the Keystone XL pipeline to a carbon fraction. I mean, this is conduct that rises to the level of suicidal conduct.
Right, but the thing is, as far as I can tell from just because I've read quite a few articles on. In the Canadian press, actually, and they even admit, you know, the oil industry that this is key to their bigger plans for tar sands.
Yeah, the tar sands is not a stopping place, it's a starting place.
Yeah, anyway, so, you know, I was kind of cringing when Obama was, you know, being kind of nonchalant about, well, it was here or there, it's going to happen no matter what type of comment. You remember that? I don't know if you saw that comment he made.
Yeah.
It was not very helpful.
No, not very helpful at all. And, well, frightening.
And so, and I have to go back to, you know, you made the best point in this conversation so far, is that it could have been, why wasn't it just tabled day one?
And I think that's a reflection of the fact that that kind of money is in both sides of this two-party structure.
Because you're absolutely right. Romney said he would, you know, as soon as he got in there, he would okay it. But we have to endure this madness of willy wonny, willy wonny. Oh yeah, it's a nightmare, man. You're right. It's really bad.
Well, and what is it that anybody's waiting to learn to find out yay or nay? I'm damned if I can figure it out. This ought to be easy. John Kerry is Secretary of State now, correct?
Yeah.
And
he just regurgitated what Obama said in the speech recently.
And he's supposed to be all green and climate changey, and it, And isn't that his call? Since it's an international pipeline, do I understand the procedure correctly that it was a call to be made by the Secretary of State's office? Because it sure was back when we were first talking about it, when it was Hillary Clinton's call.
Yeah, well, now it's Obama's call. And the thing is, maybe I'm wrong, but we all know that if it hadn't have been for, I would say, Bill McKibben's article in the Rolling Stones and just various activism hands and just sort of whatever, the Obama administration would have okayed this pipe a long time ago. Am I wrong to think that?
No, I think you're absolutely correct. And that's...
I have to let you know. I didn't mean to make the whole phone call about that, but it seems to be a decision that is going to be made by the White House. They don't have to consult anybody else. So it's just easy to laser focus on this, you know?
You know what?
Because it's so telling.
But you know what blows my mind out of this? I got an article here. Figure this one out. Because the number is, and I guess this is the answer to our question, why was it not just rejected out of hand? Supporters of Keystone XL outspend opponents 35-1. For every dollar that opponents of Keystone XL spend, the industry and its various supporters spend $35. And let's see, in total 2012 lobbying, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce spent $94,570,000. Business Roundtable spent $13,900. ExxonMobil spent $12,900. Laborers International Union of North America, International Union of Operating Engineers, Building and Construction Trades Department of the AFL-CIO, United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America, United Association of Journeymen and Apprentices of the Plumbing and Pipe Fitting Industry, they all collectively dropped $1.5 million on lobbying in favor of Keystone XL. And then this, I mean, this is just bizarre. The American Jewish Committee, describing itself as, quote, the global advocate for the well-being of the Jewish people and for the advancement of democratic values for all, unquote, dropped $100,000 lobbying in favor of the Keystone XL pipeline.
Well, you know that Nature magazine did an editorial recently chiming in for it. Do you know that?
Yeah.
Have you seen that article?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, okay. But listen, I do have to go, but I have to leave you with this. Did you know that I was looking at this, I don't know what it's about, the sea ice, but, you know, I read this stuff and I just think, I can't even register it. Okay, so the Arctic sea ice volume has declined by 36% in the autumn between 2003 and 2012. Hello?
Oh, yeah. And last year was the hottest year on record, and this year was the hottest year on record, and next year's going to keep being the hottest year on record.
No, but they're saying with the Arctic that the multi-year ice is kind of pretty much gone. That took, like, what, 500 million years to develop? Anyway,
right.
I'm
and,
sorry.
Yeah, no, and, we've, know, and we've done it in a decade. That's
right.
You know, when
I
you,
just am like, hello? Is
well, you'll get a kick out of this right before you go. You know, when you've got a 17-year-old boy in your house, things sort of, well, grab their attention differently, shall we say. So Ferg told me that he was a believer in climate change now that Sports Illustrated had apparently posed some model in a swimsuit in freaking Antarctica, and she wrote, well, you know, it's not so cold.
Oh, hey. Listen, I don't know what goes on in the minds of 17-year-old boys, and I really don't want to know.
I've been one, and you don't want to go there.
Oh, my God. Okay, well, I'm not even going to touch that. Okay, Bob, listen, have a good
Sandra,
evening.
Sandra, have a good evening. Good talking to you. Bye now. Calling from California, that's our buddy Sandra. Listen to this list. Listen to this list of supporters of the Keystone XL pipeline. American Concrete Pressure Pipe Association, they dropped $35,000. The American Council of Engineering Companies, they dropped $2.6 million. American Exploration and Production Council, they dropped $40,000. The American Foundry Society dropped $45,000. American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers, $3.7 million. American Highway Users Alliance, $120,000. Funny, I never got my membership card, and I use them fairly regularly. American Iron and Steel Institute, $482,000. American Jewish Committee, $100,000. American Petroleum Institute, no surprise, $5.1 million. American Road and Transportation Builders Association, $165,000. Association of Equipment Manufacturers, $1.3 million. Associated Equipment Distributors, $320,000. Building and Construction Trades Department, AFL-CIO, $250,000. These little labor organizations. I mean, that's a rounding error compared to the American Petroleum Institute. Business Roundtable, $13.9 million. The Center for Individual Freedom. Can we have a conversation about the Center for Individual Freedom and their $10,000 chip-in to support the Keystone XL pipeline that will do in so many individual freedoms that they can scarcely be counted? Yeah. Chamber of Commerce of the USA, $94,570,000. Chevron USA, $9.5 million. ConocoPhillips, they were cheapskating, $1.03 million. Consumer Energy Alliance, $90,000. Deer and Company, $1.395 million. Devon Energy Production Company, LP, $1.1 million. Emerson, $893,100. ExxonMobil, $12.9. You know, if there's anything, if anything serves to prove that this is not some sort of, well, like what Sandra was saying, that this is, you know, it's a market, it's a linear market that is global in nature, immediately fungible. The fact that oil companies will throw down $12, $13, $14, $15 million in a year to lobby for this vile, cancerous, toxic, species-cidal effort really ought to sort everything out. Then there's the Consumer Energy Alliance. No, we mentioned them, $90,000. I don't think I'm a member of that one either. In-Situ Oil Sands Alliance, $410,000. Heritage Action for America, $160,000. That's that creepy bunch that's now led by Jim Demented, over on Mass Avenue, not far from the AIC headquarters. Independent Petroleum Association of America, $1.2 million. International Union of Operating Engineers, $480,000. I'll bet the oil companies just laughed at that little pissant bit of money. Laborers International Union of North America, $629,000. Marathon Oil, $2.38 million. Marathon Petroleum, $2.07 million. National Association of Wholesaler Distributors, $167,000. National Rural Electric Cooperative Association, $2.06 million. I thought co-ops were supposed to be community-owned. The Keystone XL pipeline is directly inimical to community energy. Try telling them that. National Taxpayers Union, $37,774. National Association of Manufacturers, $9.17 million. Man, there's some walking around money out there. Oklahoma Independent Petroleum Association, $40,000. Quanta Services, $10,000. Shell Oil, $7.02 million. Now, we have some listeners in the state of Indiana. And being as they are members of the Horn family, they are progressive people. Go figure it out. Some portion of your tax dollars, Indiana listeners in Taliban, Indiana, went to the $52,000 that the state of Indiana gave in lobbying in favor of the Keystone XL pipeline that ain't even going to go nowhere near Indiana. Then there's the state of Indiana Office of the Governor. That's another $14,000. Texas Association of Business, $35,000. Trans-Canada Pipelines Limited, $850,000. The UA, the United Association of Journeymen and Apprentices of the Plumbing and Pipe Fitting Industry, $80,000. United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America, $120,000. I understand a labor organization just wants the jobs. But good God, look who you're in bed with. There's not a pro-labor organization in the rest of that list. But by God, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And I think, in part, at least partial answer to Sandra's question, is this. We can't have an offhand, off-the-cuff, no, we're not going to build it decision. Because we don't have anything that even remotely resembles unity on this side of the aisle. Hell, we can't even say that we've got unity inside the progressive community. Some of the most progressive people I know are members of labor unions. A lot of them oppose the Keystone XL pipeline. But their leadership wrote the check and signed it. Can I have a moment just to be a little bit venal here? Ed Schultz really is waffly on this because he's got a lot of labor support, and he started with labor support. He wound up on television because of the United Steelworkers. And so he doesn't want to piss any labor organizations off. But he also recognizes that the vast majority of progressive listeners slash viewers are much more likely to incline toward issues, toward treating seriously issues of climate change. It's a hell of a bind to be in if you're Ed. Then again, this past Monday, Ed was opining about how American workers have too many holidays. I'm so glad Michael sent that along. I needed that. But it is disheartening. The first $15,000 that got this program going came from the Carpenters and Millwrights of West Virginia. Because I believe to this day that labor needs a strong voice in this country and in this state. But it was the only $15,000 we ever got. Because we talk about things that aren't necessarily on their radar. But if all you talk about is labor, you're going to wind up with a deadly dull radio show. Look up Charles Showalter. That guy makes drying paint interesting. It's terrible. And does more harm to labor than any good he could ever possibly do. So here we are, 17 minutes before the hour. We are still $40 away from meeting Robert's challenge from down under. And yeah, I'll say it. If it makes me sound pissy, so what? There are literally hundreds of thousands of dollars down the Keystone XL rat hole thrown to people who would gladly slit the throat of labor if they got a half a chance. That is why this thing was not simply vetoed out of hand. Others as well have their take on that. Andy noting the neocons in the Israeli lobby may be for the XL pipeline because they want to keep our Middle East oil dependence alive and well so Israel can maintain its strategic global positioning as a buffer between the Arab oil sheikhs and the West. Unbelievable how short-sighted. Same thing with the unions. Baking the planet is fine as long as they pick up a few dollars. Can't they understand the long-term damage they are doing to the planet will completely nullify their short-term gains? As James Hansen says, game over. Unfortunately, they can't understand, as the saying goes, paraphrasing, a man just can't understand when his livelihood depends on it. Again, says Andy, how short-sighted. Then Ron in Raleigh says, Bob, you must understand that the crux of this lobbying effort is at its core about unenlightened self-interest. What's good for me and screw everyone else, or as our buddy Bruce up in Wisconsin would say, igamfoo, I got mine, F you. These folks will turn this country into a smoldering slag heap if they can make a penny. Your long-term misery is of no concern. See, that takes me back. Ancient history nerd time. There was more than one Roman general who rode off toward Mesopotamia and got involved with the Parthians, who were the heirs to the Persian Empire. And in one instance, I believe it was Marcus Licinius Crassus, who had hot, molten, liquid gold poured down his throat to sate his lust for the stuff. It was partially to avenge the death of Crassus that made Julius Caesar think that his next campaign was going to be against the Parthians, and he was leaving Rome on campaign in the next week or so, following the Ides of March, and that's why Brutus and Cassius and that crowd had to strike when they did. A couple of hundred years later, the same thing happened to another Roman general, although in this case, the Parthian king decided to have him stuffed and used his stuffed body as a footstool, as a sort of glaring reminder to Rome that they weren't quite the masters of the universe they thought themselves to be. Well, I guess we're past the point in human existence where we actually have enough gold to melt down and waste it pouring down the gullet of some plutocrat. But the fundamental essential problem still obtains. As it was said of the conquistadors in Mexico, they have a disease of the heart that can only be cured by gold, and more gold, and more gold, and more gold. Black gold, Texas tea, if you will. All that money. Now here's the other side. The Advocacy Fund spent $250,000 opposing Keystone XL. American Rivers spent $150,000. The Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund, dear friends of ours, spent $637,000. Environment America spent $1.9 million. Friends Committee on National Legislation spent $682,000. Friends of the Earth spent $18,000. Talk about your widow's mite. Remember how long it took me to read that whole list a minute ago? League of Conservation Voters spent $120,000. League of Women Voters of the U.S. spent $168,000. National Wildlife Federation spent $460,000. National Resources Defense Council spent $143,000. The Oglala Sioux Tribe, yay for them, spent $30,000 that they had a hell of a hard time coming up with. And the Sierra Club spent $200,000. And that's the end of the list. But I'm proud to say that there was a member of the Horn family. There was more than one member of the Horn family in attendance in Washington at the climate rally this past Sunday, the 17th of February. I've got an email here from our buddy Dr. Allen. He said, I've been away from the podcast for a few days, so I'm not sure if you discussed the Keystone XL protest in D.C. on February 17th. I was fortunate to be able to attend with my 9-year-old son. It was amazing, about 40,000 activists there. We marched from the National Mall to the White House, but as native Texans, we were frozen solid in the frigid conditions, with wind chill probably in the teens. Thanks for your work on the Horn and on mountaintop removal. Thank you for going, Dr. Allen, and more importantly, thank you for taking your 9-year-old son with you. It's hard to explain to a 9-year-old, but this is his fight, and his classmates' fights, and his cousins', and someday his children's fight. Thank you for the photos. I think it's going to have to happen again, and maybe try to make sure that the president is there this time. Of course, there's no way to control that. But one protest does not a movement make. Going to have to go back and go back and go back and go back. Because this really is existential, isn't it? This really is a question about the year 2100. And I know the labor unions and the American Petroleum Institute, they don't want to hear that. The labor unions, because they've got people on benches right now that have been on benches for years that they desperately want to get to work, because that's a union's job, is helping its membership get work. But God Almighty, look how much work there is to be had in a country that rebuilds its energy infrastructure based on wind and solar. You think there wouldn't be work there for the members of the United Association, the pipe fitters? You think there wouldn't be work there for the carpenters and the joiners? You think there wouldn't be work there for the laborers? More work there than they can do, but we have to have a country that's committed to doing it, and committing to doing it includes them saying that's what they want instead of some godforsaken filthy effing pipeline. They poured molten liquid gold down the throat of Marcus Licinius Crassus. I don't guess we'll ever see the day when an oil executive will be encouraged to drink a nice room temperature pint of tar sands crude. You got it, Will, in Chicago, Bob, he says in our chat room. Our question is indeed to be or not to be. And if James Hansen is right, and if Bill McKibben is right, and if all the scientists are right, it's really not, it's a question we're not going to have to wait very long for an answer to. The question is being answered right now with things like Sandy and Derechos and Katrina. Out of control wildfires. And just because somebody finds the answer to be incompatible with their desire to have endless access to endless money does not make the answer any different. At least the lines are brightly drawn. But it also means that at some point in time, there's got to be a call out. At some point in time, it becomes intolerable to have people who should know better banging the drum for the right to poison innocent people, take their land, destroy the water of half a continent. Because that's what this is. It is a matter of the 1% demanding the ability to trade our future for their present well-being. I mentioned it, I guess, last week on the program. It is larceny of the future. The stealing, taking, and carrying away of the goods and valuables of another with intent to deprive the true owner thereof. And whether it's Sandra's nieces or my grandkids or your kids, make no mistake, they are being deprived and they are the true owners. It's one of the things that was so inspiring about being up in Wisconsin was hearing in a clear voice and seeing in faces the absolute understanding of what it means to think out 7 generations. You put that 7 generations rule into effect, and this is a different planet. It's damn sure a different country, and better for it, into the bargain. So that's where we find ourselves at the end of this Wednesday, the 20th of February. Thank you very much. In the last few minutes, Sal and Dan put us over the top for meeting the Down Under Challenge. Deeply appreciated. Yeah, that's true, Texas Betsy. Americans can't see 7 minutes out, let alone 7 generations. It's one of the things that makes this such a pleasant undertaking. Having conversation and establishing common cause with so many people who do have the ability to look 7 generations down the road. To everybody who makes all of this happen, first and foremost, you, with your determination that this show go forward, this program, this conversation, this dialogue continue, with your contributions of your time and the energies of your communication and the simple sharing of the most precious finite thing you have, and that is your time. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to John Fox down in Australia. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org, for over 10 years now, literally saving progressive conversation, progressive talk on the Internet at White Rose Society. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and yes, ACHEACT, A-C-H-E-A-C-T, .org, ACHEACT.org. Go there. Use the tool we have where you can immediately send a note to your member of the House or the Senate, and let's get this thing passed. Let's have the win that we all so desperately need for the present and for the future. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next on the Horn.